From Cafe, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
How you doing, Ann?
Hey, Preet.
We should make a disclosure to the listeners.
Yeah.
We both have colds.
And we're both drinking delicious
tea.
It's very
yummy.
Yeah, but if we sound weird, that's why.
Yeah.
Well, it's been cold. Stranger. Yeah.
I've been traveling. It was very cold. I was in Detroit, and I was also in Vermont.
How was the Detroit show?
Great.
It was perfect timing, too, with the impeachment hearing started.
It was really good. I had a great time with the Attorney General, Dana Nessel, and with the former U.S. Attorney, Barb McQuaid.
Yeah.
One more show coming up, December 4th, in Atlanta, Sally Yates.
You've had a lot. You've been,
yeah,
barnstorming. Are you going to see the whale sharks when you're in Atlanta?
I don't know if I'll have time to see the whale sharks.
All right. I'm just saying. It's worth it.
I'm going to make it an effort.
There's also the penguin there, Charlie.
Right. Anytime there's any story about a penguin now,
I know.
People tweet it at you.
I've learned a lot about penguins.
You've carved out a niche.
I'm going to get one of those
niche
penguin backpacks and hats.
All right. I think we're overloaded with cough medicine. A lot of stuff happening.
Yeah.
Finally, we had public impeachment hearings. 3 witnesses last week and 8 coming up this week.
Yeah.
Let's talk about sort of overall impressions of last week. Who testified? We had Bill Taylor.
Yep, the U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine, the acting U.S. ambassador. We had George Kent, a senior State Department official. And then we had Marie Yovanovitch, who was the former ambassador to the Ukraine.
Who was drummed out.
Yes.
So I thought they were all powerful witnesses. Did you?
I thought it was extraordinary. And I'll say this. I felt proud to be an American last week watching them testify. And we'll talk more about this today, but I watched 3 individuals who are career government servants and get up there, take the oath to tell the truth. And I thought they came across as so forthright, honest, telling what they had experienced. And it's the best of who we are. And none of those 3 sought that out. It's a terrible situation for any of them to be in. And I thought they did an excellent job of explaining what was happening and why they were so concerned.
So there were a few things that I found interesting. One, let's talk about this. The criticism they got on Fox News and other places, just get that out of the way quickly. It's astonishing to me that you could decide to mock them and criticize them as, among other things, the 2 men who testified were referred to by, I forget who, it might have been Rush Limbaugh, as geeks and nerds who probably ate alone at the cafeteria in high school. You know who did that?
Yeah.
Me. Oh. and then I got subpoena power. So the idea that being intelligent or in some way being, I don't know even what that means anymore, being a nerd is a terrible thing is odd to me. Jeanine Pirro made fun of George Kent for wearing a bow tie.
Yeah, I mean, but isn't it just such
I don't favor the bow tie, but
yeah,
like that's in some quarters, not all quarters, but that in some quarters is what passes for criticism among Trump's allies, and I find that kind of shocking.
Well, to me, it was just a sign that they could not assail the credibility of these witnesses, that they really came across as great, as honest brokers. And, you know, at the point
never
which—
Never Trumpers. I thought they were never Trumpers.
Well, at the point which you're making fun of somebody's clothes,
yeah,
it generally means that you don't have anything substantive that you can argue. And so I took some of that with a grain of salt, but it is beneath the sort of level of discourse that we should be having to be making fun of them as nerds and— Look.
Yeah. Look, and then the second level of criticism launched by Donald Trump is to basically say anybody who has come to testify and says something negative or harmful is a never-Trumper. These guys, by the way, were asked, all 3 of them, sort of late in each of the hearings, are you a never-Trumper? And they said no, and there's no evidence for that either.
Actually, on the contrary, I think if we learned more about Bill Taylor, he's a conservative. I mean, his mentors are Republicans. I would be surprised that any of these folks are, quote, never Trumpers. The other thing I noticed during the testimony is that there's this whole effort to, I don't know if I want to say confuse it, but there's a whole effort to say none of the information that they have is firsthand, which isn't accurate in my view, and we should talk about that. But it's also, these people may, you know, they weren't able to assail their credibility, so they're saying, well, they don't really know. Like, they don't have information. So this idea that the information isn't firsthand, I want to argue with for 2 basic reasons. First, there is a fair amount of firsthand information going directly to the president, right? And so there is some of that information that goes to the president. But even put that aside for a minute, if Bill Taylor says, I had a conversation with Gordon Sondland, that he has firsthand information of his conversation with Gordon Sondland. So the fact that the president isn't sitting in the room is normal and happens all the time in criminal cases and other cases that people testify as to information that they have or information that they heard, particularly in the context of this kind of investigation. So I just – I heard it enough last week. It feels to me like it's going to be one of their sort of central arguments that it's secondhand.
Right.
Nobody actually heard the president say this directly. But we also have the phone call.
Right. There are other problems with that argument also. One is a procedural one, and that is – in the context of an impeachment proceeding, which is roughly analogous to a grand jury proceeding, you can absolutely get evidence that involves hearsay. Is that enough to convict someone at trial, either in the Senate or in, you know, criminal court? You know, perhaps not. But entire cases are brought by bringing in the case agent who basically summarizes the testimony and the conversations that he's had with other people. So it fails with respect to that. Second, there are lots of reasons why you bring in a witness to testify. Obviously, some of the most compelling testimony, which we're going to hear, comes from people who had direct conversations with the president of the United States. And that most, I think, squarely puts the president in the dock. But to my mind, Ambassador Yovanovitch testified in a way that was incredibly important to undermining the president's defense, right? And those witnesses are important too. And the president's defense, or one of the many shifting defenses, is whatever I asked Ukraine to do was in the interests of America generally, and because of my, you know, strong view on corruption generally.
Yep.
Not about the Bidens, but corruption generally. So every witness and every piece of evidence and every bit of testimony that makes clear that that's a crock of nonsense, that the President of the United States cared only about the Bidens and not about corruption generally, is useful in connection with impeachment.
Right.
And remember, my friend and former colleague Dan Goldman began his examination of Ambassador Yovanovitch with a really powerful story. I don't know if it was known before and he just, you know, crystallized it, or if it was revelation. It was revelation to me. And on the day when she was told she had to get the hell out of Ukraine and she was basically being removed from her position, what was she doing in Ukraine that day? She and other diplomats from the United States were giving an award to the father of a murdered corruption fighter who had acid poured on her, showing that to the extent the president cared about corruption, here you had Ambassador Yovanovitch, who generally had a reputation for being anti-corruption, and wonderful on that issue, and is asked to leave the country on the day that she's taking steps to honor someone who was also in favor of fighting corruption. That's a very powerful undermining of the narrative of the president that he cared about corruption.
Yeah, I agree. Look, I think all three witnesses added a lot of information. One of the things I also found chilling about her testimony was this discussion of she didn't even know. I mean, she'd been removed before the phone call happened on July 25th. But when you sort of – Dan Goldman walks her through when does she first learn about that phone call, and it's when it's publicly released.
Yeah.
And so that was just a very authentic, sincere moment of her, I think, being stunned by the fact that she's been – targeted by the president of the United States, and that there are two heads of state talking about their ambassador in this way. It really does undercut the ability of the U.S. diplomatic corps in such a fundamental way. And again, she doesn't give us the investigations as much as Taylor and Kent did, but she was an important part of the story last week, and I thought her testimony was really powerful.
Yeah.
When the call between Trump and Zelensky, when you know, Trump basically says, you know, I understand that there had been a lot of problems with the ambassador, and that she's bad news. And what's the quote? She's gonna
go through some things.
She's gonna go through some things, and that is
ominous.
Yeah. What do you make of the president tweeting out while she was testifying?
Look, so Ambassador Yovanovitch was asked about her reaction to some of these things on that phone call, and Yovanovitch says it didn't sound good. It sounded like a threat, and it kind of does. And the thing to always remember is, the president of the United States is not an ordinary person. When the president says it, it's different.
What did you think when President Trump told President Zelensky and you read that you were going to go through some things?
I didn't know what to think, but I was very concerned.
What were you concerned about?
She's going to go through some things. It didn't sound good. It sounded like a threat.
Did you feel threatened?
I did.
Which leads to the point that you were just making about this you know, arguably intimidating tweet in the middle of Yovanovitch's testimony. And I don't think I'd actually even seen the tweet because I was watching the hearing and Danny Goldman was doing the examination. And then, you know, I'm partial to his doing examination because he's a career guy.
Yeah.
And then Adam Schiff interrupts, like, why are you interrupting Goldman? And the reason he was interrupting staff counsel was to read to Masha Yovanovitch the tweet by the president. Here's what the president tweeted. Everywhere Marie Yovanovitch went turned bad. She started off in Somalia. How did that go? Can we just pause on that for a second?
I think she was in her late 20s
in Mogadishu.
Yeah.
And it's a sign, actually, of her expertise and sensitivity that she got such a posting.
But she's a junior foreign service officer for the United States government. And
no, she's responsible for Somalia, obviously.
Yes, and everything that happened there, yes.
Then he goes on in his tweet, then fast forward to Ukraine, where the new Ukrainian president spoke unfavorably about her in my second phone call with him. It is a U.S. president's absolute right to appoint ambassadors. They call it serving at the pleasure of the president. The U.S. now has a very strong and powerful foreign policy, much different than preceding administrations. I think he meant preceding administrations. It is called, quite simply, America First. With all of that, however, I have done far more for Ukraine than O.
Meaning
who do you
Obama.
Think he means Obama? Obama. Oh, that
yeah,
O.
I think I so, see. Yeah.
So a lot has been made of whether that constitutes witness tampering, for which there's an actual criminal statute that involves intimidation of a witness, trying to get a witness not to testify or alter their testimony. Before we get to that, just on a common sense level and on a decency level, it's obnoxious. It's, in layperson's terms, I think, intimidating and unhelpful. And yeah. I think, you know, that was a turn. The president made a hearing that was somewhat important, a lot more important, and made a witness who was
Absolutely.
Somewhat important, a lot more important.
Yeah.
By doing that in the middle of a hearing, and it also caused a human element to be introduced into the proceedings and this very pointed and poignant back and forth between Adam Schiff and the witness. Did you feel that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a completely unscripted moment, and the president is tweeting out about her, and then Schiff is reading it to her. And it also shows how absurd it is that the president has vilified this career foreign service officer. You know, my personal read on it is that I would not charge that as a crime for a variety of reasons, including the fact that she's already testifying.
He's not, like, in other words, as a pure technical matter, and I want to make a point about whether or not we should be dissecting this in this way, but I saw a lot of people on TV doing it and a lot of members of Congress doing it. I don't know that the proper standard is, does it, you know, meet all the elements of a particular statute.
And the only reason I think we're having this conversation is that Adam Schiff seemed to suggest that it was the conversation we should be having, which is, you know, we in Congress, he said something to the effect of, we in Congress take witness intimidation very seriously.
Yeah.
So I think he raised this. But look, the first and most important point is that the president shouldn't have done it. It's terrible. It's by far and away an outrageous thing for him to do and beneath the office of the presidency. And so there's no question.
Counterproductive. Why does he do it?
Yes. If anyone was advising him with any sensibility, they would have told him not to do it. So again, it's also evidence that the president listens only to himself. But the piece about the intimidation that's interesting is, to me, she's already sitting there. She's telling her story. She's going to tell her story either way. But it does show you that the president is going to, and this happened to the woman who works for, and we'll talk about her in a second, she's coming up this week, the woman who's works for Vice President Pence. He tweeted out about her over the weekend when information about her deposition behind closed doors became public. Like, everybody's on notice. If you go against the president, he's going to vilify you and come out against you publicly. And so,
do you think he treats women?
I do.
Differently?
I do a little, because, you know, if you look at who he was tweeting out about, he's tweeting out about Yovanovitch, and he's tweeting out about Jennifer Williams. And so Trump's invective, his anger, seems to be, at least here, you know, we've seen it a lot coming at women. And so I don't want to get too hung up on it, because I think his behavior is generally terrible across the board when it comes to witnesses and to this investigation. And it's been reported he's angry with Pompeo, the Secretary of State, for letting, I mean, not that he had a choice, but allowing folks in the State Department to testify. So some of it is not gendered, but there is something about the very public nature of him picking out these two women. What do you think?
Yeah, that seems the case. I mean, people will then argue, well, he says bad things about everybody. But, and I haven't gone through every single instance of every obnoxious thing he said about every human being who said something bad about him. But he does seem to reserve particular animosity and outrage and freak out for women. He does.
Yeah. And, you know, George Kent and Bill Taylor also gave very damaging testimony to the president. And by the way, I wanted to just get your reaction. One of my favorite lines of the week was George Kent when he said,
as I mentioned in my testimony, you can't promote principled anti-corruption action without pissing off corrupt people.
Fair enough.
And that, to me, sort of captured a lot of a lot of this. And it was clear the president was angry.
So going back to the witness intimidation, you know, a lot of people said I heard former colleagues of ours say it's textbook witness tampering. And part of the reason why I think if we were in a regular criminal situation, you wouldn't charge it based on that tweet is, as you said, it wasn't preventing her from testifying. It was not an explicit threat. He was expressing, you know, distaste for the person, which he obviously had done before on a phone call. Maybe that makes it worse because, you know, there's something to back it up, you know, this feeling. She's still in the employment of the administration, right? So, you know, people should remember she's not fired. She was just withdrawn from, you know, that bit of service in Ukraine. And so, you know, I think it's a terrible thing. Not quite sure if it's chargeable. Obviously, people want to make it into a potential charge because that would justify it more squarely as a freestanding article of impeachment.
So here's the weird thing. I mean, I don't think they should do that. I don't think it's there. And again, the legal definition, 18 United States Code 1512, subsections B and D, tampering with a witness, victim, or informant, it all goes towards inducing somebody to not testify or to change their testimony. And so this does feel more to me like it's intended for other people, not just her. But put that aside for a second. What is interesting about it is that we also saw this a lot with the Mueller investigation, that the president was just launching constant sort of things like this and basically – you know, trying to, I don't know if I should say threaten, but basically trying to sort of really set this divide that if you go against me, something, you know, something bad might happen to you. And so there may ultimately be enough of these things if it keeps happening that you could bring a general tampering charge. But right now, off that one thing, I wouldn't do it.
I agree with you with respect to that particular thing, which not everyone is going to agree with us when we say that, when they listen to this. But here's the thing that keeps sitting in my head on the issue of if and when the president should be held accountable for his conduct. And it's something that Jill Lepore, the historian from Harvard, said on my podcast, on the Stay Tuned podcast last week. And it just keeps buzzing around in my head. And it is this. The president is uniquely able to engage in conduct that is problematic. And in the context that she and I were talking about it, we were saying, you know, Jill Lepore or Ann Milgram or Preet Bharara, we can't call up the president of Ukraine and extort that person. The only person who's capable of doing that is the president of the United States. The only person who is capable of engaging in a certain kind of intimidation, whether it's with respect to Yovanovitch directly or all future witnesses, is the president.
Yeah.
He's the head of the government. He's the commander in chief. He has the largest bully pulpit on the planet. He has more authority and power in reality, not just soft power, than anyone on the planet. And if you believe Bill Barr's view of executive power, it's even more than what you and I have always presumed a president to have in terms of power.
Yeah.
And so when a president of the United States, whether or not it's technically, you know, an extortion or whether or not it's technically witness intimidation, as you and I understand it, with like the guy down the street when you were in your job and when I was in my job, when the president of the United States on a repeated basis, when facing testimony from honorable public servants who are reluctantly testifying to the facts that they witnessed and the things that they said and heard, when he engages in a pattern of this kind of tweeting and character assassination and lies and calling, you know, people never-Trumpers and everything else, that in sum, I think, is potentially a separate impeachable offense. It's obstruction.
Yeah, to charge it as a pattern of activity, I think that's when it becomes a more interesting question versus this one instance. But look, there's no question, I think, that if people came forward and testified honestly, and I don't necessarily expect this to happen because I think that the president has convinced a lot of people not to testify. But I think if people came forward, there are people who would make it very clear that the president has expressed that people should not cooperate with this investigation. And again, to your point, he's so powerful that the president of the United States saying, I don't want you to cooperate. And what becomes tricky about it is that there are instances in which the president can validly argue executive privilege. I think ultimately, if this gets litigated, those arguments might fail. But because impeachment is akin to a criminal prosecution, there's precedent prior cases that say in criminal prosecutions that executive privilege can fail. It's not an absolute privilege. So I think there's a lot to be said for that, but there's a slightly legitimate argument of him being able to say to somebody like John Bolton, don't testify, or to others. And so that's why this gets a little bit more complicated. But
can I make a mild criticism of some of the Democrats and how they ask questions? So every once in a while, a member of the majority, the Democrats, would, I thought, go too far in trying to elicit from Yovanovitch in particular, but the other witnesses also, but especially Yovanovitch, you know, how did you feel? And were you upset? And, you know, a little bit of that is fine. I can't remember who the questioner was, but it was a little bit, to me, too much. And it was a little bit more about, you know, showing her to be a victim, and she sort of was. But I think they do better just to stick to the facts, stick to the conversations, and that kind of thing. And then Adam Schiff, who I think, by the way, has the patience of Job, and who showed himself to be unflappable. He's not perfect. You know, he made that mistake with the parody that they exploit to the ends of the earth. But I thought he's done a magnificent job of just patiently acknowledging members or not acknowledging them based on what the rules are, and just proceeding with what he's trying to do, and he doesn't get sidetracked and derailed. There's only one time where I thought he fell into this, I think, not great line of questions, and it was in the moment when he was asking about the president's tweet.
Right.
And he says to Yovanovitch, what effect do you think that has on other witnesses willing to come forward and expose wrongdoing? And Yovanovitch says, well, it's very intimidating, all well and good. And then he asks, and I might have asked this question, but I think it was a mistake. Schiff then asks,
designed to intimidate, is it not?
Which I think was not a great question, because it asks her to put herself in the mind,
yes,
of the president.
Exactly.
And it ended up being, and it also seemed like he was trying to sort of push the intimidation point.
And they could have just left it at, she said, it's intimidating.
I think so. But it ends up being fine, because she is such a modest witness and answered with such humility that her answer, I think, became important. And she hesitates and she says,
I mean, I can't speak to what the president is trying to do, but I think the effect is to be intimidating.
Which actually bolstered her as a witness. She didn't go out of her way to slam the president. By the way, this happens over and over again. One of the great talking points of the president's allies after the two gentlemen testified was they get asked, you know, what's impeachable here? And they said, well, that's not the job we're doing here. We're not pronouncing those judgments. We have no view as to the ultimate outcome. We're just here, and Bill Taylor said this, I think, credibly, repeatedly. I'm here to tell you what I saw, what I heard, and what I know, and I'm not here to pronounce judgment on impeachment, which I thought made them more credible witnesses.
I agree.
And meanwhile, the president's allies are saying, oh, that's dispositive. They couldn't identify anything impeachable. It's not that they couldn't. I bet they do think it's impeachable.
Yeah.
But it would have hurt their credibility to come there and say, we think the president should be impeached. And it's a weird inversion of what actually went on in the hearing that you keep seeing on the airwaves all the time.
Yeah, I agree. And I thought that... It did make them more credible that they said, look, it's not our job. Our job is to tell you, you know, we've been subpoenaed here as witnesses to tell you what we saw. So one of the questions I think that's come out is this question of Yovanovitch is removed and then Taylor is put in, and he comes across very credibly as a lifelong diplomat, government servant. And so one of the questions that's been raised is, if she was really removed because she's fighting corruption, why did they replace her with somebody who, you know, also seems to be quite capable and like a straight arrow? And I guess, you know, there are a couple of possible answers to that, Preet, and I'd love to get your thoughts on it too. But one is that Giuliani and others targeted her, thought that they couldn't influence her, that she was... gonna basically stand in their way, and they wanted her out. So they were less concerned completely at the moment in time about who took her place as they were about ousting her. The second very possible reason is that there are others in the State Department who were clearly, I mean, Kent testified to how upset he was that she was ousted, that no one at the leadership of the State Department had spoken out on her behalf. There's probably also a sense of, if they didn't replace her with somebody who was credible, that it would look even more political and damning than it already was, and that they were losing credibility within the State Department. So those are a couple of reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, I think that sometimes they make the decision that someone is bad news and is not helping them with whatever nefarious undertakings they want to engage in. And sometimes, and I'm not trying to be over cute when I say this, sometimes they accidentally replace good people with another good person, you know? Jim Comey was fired for particular reasons, and I think the replacement is another honorable person. And people have their you know, their disputes about Jim Comey and some of the conduct he engaged in and the statements he made. But Chris Wray, I think, you know, has done right by the FBI, and he keeps a low profile, and he's like sort of a professional. And I don't know that they fully perceived that Bill Taylor would come along and become a witness reluctantly and talk about the things he saw. So I, you know.
Yeah, they might have thought he was more of a loyalist. And also, remember, Taylor, his position on the irregular chain of communication of sort of foreign policy. There's the regular sort of foreign policy toward Ukraine and this irregular, he describes it as like this other form of foreign policy that's happening. He says, and it's an interesting thing, that he was okay with there being these two different forms, right? The sort of regular
the channels,
thank you. The regular and irregular channels, so long as they had the same goal, as so long as their mission was unified. And when he got concerned is when it became clear that it wasn't, that they didn't want the same things for Ukraine, that the formal channel wanted to keep the traditional U.S. policy toward Ukraine, and that the informal was all about the investigations and other issues. And so, but Taylor up front may have been actually more willing to sort of go with the fact that Giuliani was involved and that there were these other people who were sort of putting their finger in the pie. And so maybe they wanted him because he would be receptive to that. I mean, it's really impossible for us to know other than to just say that they clearly replaced Yovanovitch with somebody who was talented and seems to have been a, you know, thoughtful replacement.
We should be clear on something. This is not as a harsh criticism of anyone, but all these people who have come and testified, none of them blew the whistle. I mean, some of them went and talked to counsel at the National Security Council, lawyers, I mean, they talked to, and, you know, registered internally some concern about it. Some of them took notes, but none of them came forward and operated under the whistleblowing statute to say this is a terrible thing that went on.
Yeah.
So
it's a good point.
You know, in that regard, I think it's courageous what they're doing. They're coming forward, but they did not break this out into the open. That happened on the basis of some whistleblower whose identity is still unknown.
It's a great point. Once it was out in the open, they cooperated. But yeah, it's a great point that they weren't the whistleblowers themselves. What did you make so I thought Dan Goldman, just going back for a minute to the way the questioning happened, I really did think, and you and I talked about this, that it was hugely advantageous to have that 45-minute period where there was questioning that was going to happen by a professional staff member. Dan Goldman, former Southern District, did an excellent job in my view. He was also, one of the things I found really impressive is that he was just straight. He wasn't making conclusions. He just did a good, effective job of asking questions and letting the witness answer, and it was compelling.
So people keep asking me, do you think he was nervous? Do you think, did he sleep the night before? And, you know, I was thinking about it, and maybe it's interesting for people to understand how these things go. Obviously, the whole world is watching, and obviously, it is a huge burden to be questioning somebody with the stakes being as high as they are, and we're investigating the sitting president of the United States. And lots of annoying people like you and I are going to be Monday morning quarterbacking, quite literally, and talking about people's performances. So that obviously makes it difficult. The degree of difficulty is high. On the other hand, I've tried to explain to people that, you know, the degree of difficulty as a lawyer who has the experience and the seasoning that someone like Daniel Goldman has, not so hard. You had three witnesses who were friendly, whose testimony was already known, whose depositions were already taken largely by him. And you know also you have 45 minutes, and so you hit the key things. And so I think, you know, there's some care that has to be taken as to what you elicit because you have limited amount of time. But you know what the highlights are? You know that you're going to be fought on some things, not fought on other things. You don't go beyond the scope of the answers that you already know are coming. And so as a matter of actual examination, not the hardest thing that Dan Goldman has ever done, compared to rehabilitating a corrupt and murderous, you know, mafia hitman, which is something that he has done on the stand.
I think that this week is going to be
more
challenging.
Where he earns his government salary.
Yes, agreed.
Bit more. And we'll get to those witnesses in a moment. But what did you think of Castor?
Yes, so this is what I was going to ask you, and I will tell you first my view. He's the Republican staff member. So, you know, I did CNN last week, and I was asked to sort of predict how it would go with Dan Goldman and Steve Castor. And I said I thought that they would both be very professional and very well prepared, and that they would come across as good questioners. I was wrong on Castor, and I'll tell you what, I was surprised by it. I expected him to be one of the things about Goldman. He made it seem effortless in some ways, but he was extraordinarily well prepared. He knew everything those witnesses had said in the deposition.
Yeah.
And Castor felt to me like he was very underprepared, and I was surprised by it.
So I
don't want to throw too much shade at him, but yeah. I expected there to be sort of a level of questioning from both the D's and the R's that I thought he was not great.
So I was more critical of Castor on day one. And then I thought to myself, you know, he's clearly not as good as some other people and some other former colleagues of yours and mine who have a lot of trial experience. I don't know that he has any trial experience.
That's a fair point. I don't think he does.
But then in fairness, you know, you see sometimes lawyers flail around a little bit when they don't have a lot to work with. And my other thought was some of the members of Congress who don't have a lot to work with when they're attacking these witnesses. Nonetheless, whether you like it or not, I think it's not helpful, but they do have the boldness of, you know, making speeches and yelling and screaming and engaging in histrionics because they don't have a lot and they can beat the table. But they're members of Congress. If you're the lawyer, you're the staff lawyer for that committee and you don't have a lot to work with, I don't think you can actually resort to doing what some of these members did, which is yell and holler and scream and make innuendo and long speeches, because you kind of have to be the lawyer. And so you strip away this other sort of theater that some of the members engage in. What are you left with?
I think he had more than he was able to use. Because look, when you cross-examine witnesses, that even the best witnesses have, there are opportunities and places where you can push them.
No, that's true. I don't mean to give him too much credit, but maybe he doesn't deserve as much criticism as he's gotten.
The preparation piece is the piece that surprised me.
Well, he didn't know the answers to some of the questions he was asking. The best comment I thought, which was mildly obnoxious but also funny to me, and I'm paraphrasing it, someone on social media said that Steve Castor is questioning Ambassador Yovanovitch as if she was some intriguing lady he met on the train. it's kind of like, so,
how you doing?
Tell me what else you have in your mind. What's going on? And then, wow, that's so fascinating. What kind of code is that?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely had the sense of, wasn't he there? Hasn't he read the transcripts? And look, the transcripts are voluminous, but when that's your job, you know every fact forward and backward. And that was what surprised me. By the way, here's another thing. You know, Bill Taylor testifies, and he testifies that a member of his staff, when Taylor's out on July 26th, the day after the phone call with the president, and this has been publicly reported, that there's a member of his staff who goes to this restaurant with Gordon Sondland. Sondland has a call with the president, and Sondland makes it clear the president cares more about the investigations into the Bidens than he does about Ukraine. And so this is the first time that this has come out. And so, you know, Taylor was deposed in October, and this is a really...
I think it's a big, big, big deal.
It's a big deal. It's really important. It's important evidence. It's also a place where Castor could have asked a lot of questions about why Taylor hadn't come forward earlier. So just, you know, I want to be thoughtful and not too critical of him, but there were things that came out, and I was sitting there thinking, wow, how did you not know that till recently?
So just while we're on the issue of assessing how well the various questioners did, there was a particular Republican, Elise Stefanik, from New York, who got a lot of attention for her questioning. Now, so two big things happened with respect to her. One was, and I thought she deserved all the criticism she got for this, she and Devin Nunes made a whole show, and I thought a game, of having Devin Nunes yield to her during that first 45-minute period that he got equal to what Adam Schiff and Dan Goldman got, and tried to yield to Representative Stefanik.
I know, Ms. Stefanik, you had a few quick questions for the ambassador. Yield to you, Ms. Stefanik.
Thank you, Mr. Nunes. Ambassador Yovanovitch, thank you for being here today.
The gentlewoman was suspended.
What is the interruption for this time? It is our time.
The gentlewoman was suspended. You're not recognized. Mr. Nunes, you are minority counsel.
I just recognized.
Under the House Resolution 660, you are not allowed to yield time except to minority counsel.
The ranking member yielded time to another member of Congress.
No, that is not accurate.
And Stefanik says, as if she's fully innocent, to Adam Schiff, when Adam Schiff cuts her off, says, what is the interruption for this time? The chair yielded to another member of Congress, as if that's fine and proper in the ordinary course. As she well knew, and as Nunes well knew, and as you and I know, and we recited this on this show, whether you like it or not, and you can decide you don't like it, but the House resolution made very clear that for 45 minutes apiece, the only people who are allowed to ask questions are the chair and ranking member or a designated staff member on the respective staffs. That's it.
Yeah.
And that was for the purpose of not allowing it to devolve into these, you know, 5-minute rounds where you can just, you know, yield to all sorts of people. The whole point of that would have been undermined if it was permissible for Devin Nunes or Adam Schiff, for that matter, to keep yielding to other people to do their quick rounds. The whole idea was to avoid that.
Yeah. It felt like game playing, too. Like, Nunes knew that. She knew it. It was too much, in my view, as
theater.
Well. Yeah.
And they started raising money off of it.
Yeah.
And they got everyone to you know, repeat the talking point that Adam Schiff cuts off women.
Right.
So I thought that was preposterous and
It was done in bad faith as well. I mean, I think your point is well taken, that the rules are the rules and they don't have to like them, but they were publicly set forth. And
but then on the other hand, and there's some people out there who are so invested in what they want the result to be, that no question from a Democrat is bad and no question from a Republican is good. And there are questions that have been asked. I said this during the Mueller hearing. John Ratcliffe, I think, asks a lot of questions in bad faith. He's a Republican. But even bad faith questions can be effective and can change public sentiment. You and I have seen that in court. You can have a defense lawyer who's making a bad faith argument or a bad faith objection or a bad faith question, but it's very slyly done, and it can be, and it can work, which is why you object to it. And there's really no one to mediate and monitor objections to be made here. And I thought she made some headway in a couple of places. I think at the end of the day, there are answers to all of these things. But I thought she scored some points.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I also thought that she's pushed back on Trump in a few different spaces.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. So she's clearly come around to Team Trump. But one of the reasons I found it to be a little bit effective at times, and again, I think all of the questions she raised are answerable, but part of it was just that she's a new voice and she was less, you know, at this point, I do find some of it is shrill to me that they're always sort of saying the same thing. And she was a new voice articulating and questioning. And she seemed a little bit, she was asking more questions. She was sort of more focused on substantive questions in some ways. And again,
and she asked short questions.
Yeah.
And there was one, again, I think they made more out of it than it deserves to be made out of it. But she adduced some testimony that I think most people were not familiar with, that at the time that Yovanovitch was going through a confirmation process, during the preparatory phase, the State Department, the Obama State Department, had some concern, it seems, about questions relating to Burisma and Ukraine.
And Hunter Biden.
And Hunter Biden. And she was essentially prepared to be able to deflect that to the State Department.
And you testified that in this particular practice Q&A with the Obama State Department, it wasn't just generally about Burisma and corruption. It was specifically about Hunter Biden and Burisma. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And the exact quote from your testimony, Ambassador, is, quote, "The way the question was phrased in this model Q&A was, what can you tell us about Hunter Biden's, you know, being named to the board of Burisma?" So for the millions of Americans watching, President Obama's own State Department was so concerned about potential conflicts of interest from Hunter Biden's role at Burisma that they raised it themselves while prepping this wonderful ambassador nominee before her confirmation.
So there's some level of concern on the part of the Obama folks about this arrangement, which is, you know, is a point to be made.
Yeah. And I mean, you and I have both said it before, the arrangement should not have existed.
Yeah.
It was bad judgment. And so, first of all, she was prepared and she knew that fact. And again, that's one of the things that makes questioning good, is that she knew information. Second of all, it did show this point, which is that there was a sensitivity, at least in the State Department, to Burisma. My husband, Manuel, keeps telling me that I make
Burisma.
It Italian. It's Burisma.
It's Burisma. Burisma.
He said it's like you're ordering something at Starbucks. Anyway, Burisma and Hunter Biden. And the one thing I didn't like about this, and I thought it was the most effective moment that she had, was just to basically be like, look, you know, it's not okay for the president to have questions about this. The Obama's own State Department had questions about it, which is where it was going. But the one thing I didn't like is she was trying to make such a big deal about the fact that she was prepped for her hearings, which everyone yeah. gets prepped for hearings. Everyone gets mooted, meaning you get asked mock questions. And so some of it I thought was disingenuous, or at least, you know, again, this is what good questioners can do. The rest of the public doesn't know this, but some of it felt
right.
a little bit too much.
Well,
to me.
It's further to this veneer of suggestive nefariousness over all sorts of things that are totally not, like Nunes begins to say on Friday when they adjourn and close out the Yovanovitch testimony, and now we're going back down into this bunker for another secret deposition. Like, okay, it's not secret. We all know about it.
And all the transcripts are coming out.
On the TV, and you get to be there, and a lot of Republicans get to be there. And, you know, some of that information is going to become public. So this leads us to the behind closed door, for now, testimony of David Holmes, who was an embassy staffer reporting to Bill Taylor. And I think this is a big deal and bigger than I think some other people think. And I'm curious as to how important you think it is. So as you mentioned, early last week, Bill Taylor testifies that there was apparently the day after the Trump-Zelensky call on the 25th of July, the next day on July 26th, there was a Trump-Sondland call. What's remarkable about that, if you believe the testimony that we've seen, and that's both Bill Taylor and also David Holmes, because his opening statement has become available, is think of the circumstances of that. The President of the United States gets called by Gordon Sondland, who says, by the way, he doesn't have that close a relationship to the president. He can't wait till a normal business day, like the following Monday.
Or use a secure phone.
He can't wait for a secure phone. He can't wait to be back in the embassy. He can't wait to leave the restaurant. He's in an open restaurant. That's how pressing it seems it was to Gordon Sondland to report back to the boss. By the way, couldn't wait for the Secretary of State to be on the call. Couldn't wait for a lot of other people to be on the call so it's properly recorded and digested by the diplomatic corps. Couldn't wait for any of those things. And decides he needs to call in to the President of the United States.
While sitting in an outdoor, outside at a restaurant. Yeah,
on an unsecure phone, which now people think clearly there must be a transcript of that.
Somewhere in Russia.
Somewhere in Russia.
Yeah.
If not a recording of that somewhere in Russia. So even before you get to the substance of what was said, to me, and I presume that, Dan Goldman will elicit this from Sondland on Wednesday when he testifies, and we'll talk in a moment about what his strategy is going to be, Sondland's strategy is going to be, that to me is super strange.
It's
of all the things going on in the world, that notification and call needed to happen. Now,
do you think he was bragging? Because I thought myself, first of all, apparently Sondland often made calls from his personal cell phone, which is beyond crazy when you think about the way that the U.S. diplomatic corps works. It doesn't happen. These are very sensitive questions, and it could be hacked by the Russians. It could be – there's just a ton of reasons why you just don't do it. So first of all, there's a level of, I can't believe this guy would do this. That's a piece of this. But the other piece is – you know, it's like he's sitting with three other – so David Holmes testifies. He goes out to lunch with Sondland, but so do two other members of the staff from the American Embassy in Ukraine. So there's three staffers there with Sondland, and Sondland is having this conversation that you would think he would know is not appropriate to be having, number one, in front of – because of the nature of it, that it's so problematic, it shouldn't be happening in front of members of his staff and shouldn't be happening in an outdoor restaurant.
Here's a small bit of the testimony that you and I were talking about before we started recording that tells you a little bit about what your insight should be on Gordon Sondland. Remember, Gordon Sondland was in the hospitality business, doesn't know anything about foreign policy or diplomacy as a profession.
And is far over his ski tips.
Way over his skis. And he gave $1 million to the inauguration of Donald Trump, and now he becomes the ambassador to the European Union. And David Holmes testifies that when they go to lunch on a Saturday on July 26th, that they're sitting around, they get a bottle of wine. By the way, he's also drinking, which is, I guess, necessary before you call the president of the United
States. Yes, Sondland orders a bottle of wine.
At lunch.
Yep.
I'm not criticizing that, just noting it. And what was their conversation about? Marketing strategies for his hotel business.
Yeah.
they're in Ukraine. Here's the ambassador to the EU, and they're talking about marketing strategies. And in the middle of talking about marketing strategies for his hotel,
he pulls out his phone.
He's like, oh, time to call POTUS.
Yeah.
And by the way, the other interesting part about that I think is there's a little bit, I don't know if it was intended or not, but there's all the shade in David Holmes' testimony. He says Sondland goes through, you know, various levels of switchboards, I guess, at the White House, finally gets the president on the line. He stiffens up and he changes his demeanor because he's on the phone with the president. And he tells the president, I'm in Kiev, which until last week I thought was pronounced Kiev and apparently pronounced Kiev.
Kiev.
So I haven't decided yet what I'm going to adopt. Probably stick with Kiev for now.
Yeah.
And he says to the president, I'm in Kiev. And then in the testimony, he says the president clarified that Sondland was in Ukraine.
Wait, where is Kiev?
I don't know what the clarified means. And then what does Holmes say he heard in connection with the conversation?
Basically, what David Holmes says is that he hears Ambassador Sondland clarify that he is in Ukraine. And then Sondland goes on to state that President Zelensky, quote, loves your ass.
Wait.
Yeah.
Come on.
You want it with more gusto?
I was on CNN when that, like moments before coming on.
This is a family show, Preet.
This broke, and I'm just watching a CNN correspondent in real time, not knowing what he's reading. He's just sort of, you know, someone has pointed him to a page.
Yeah.
He had to pause on loves your ass. This is what we have to say now.
This is how we describe foreign policy. And then Holmes goes on to say, I then heard President Trump ask, so he's going to do the investigation. Ambassador Sondland replied that he's going to do it, adding that President Zelensky will do anything you ask him to. And then Holmes goes on to say, you know, I have a clear recollection of these statements and my other colleagues also heard it. By the way, you know, I don't know if you have grandparents who talk loud in phones, but I have to admit when I was listening to this, I was having this moment of like picturing, you know, Donald Trump just screaming into the phone, and the phone, you know, the fact that Holmes is sitting across from Sondland or next to Sondland and is able to hear this is a pretty amazing thing.
So why is that so important? To me, it's really important if it's corroborated and people find it credible, which I do, is it's now the second time we have the President of the United States himself inserting himself into this channel and showing what he was concerned about. You know, Mueller testifies on July 24th. That ends. July 25th, he has a specific call with the president of Ukraine. The next, and he knows there's going to be meetings that are going on between his folks and the Ukrainian folks. Next day, Saturday, can't wait till Monday, can't wait for a secure phone. Sondland must know that. Reports to a happy boss that the thing that you care about is going to be done. And what is that? Investigations. It goes directly to the state of mind of the President of the United States. What does he care about? Not corruption generally. He cares about, and not just an investigation specifically, but even more pointedly than that, the announcement of an investigation. That's what he wanted. That's what he thinks he's getting. And Sondland, stupidly, has this conversation in a restaurant with witnesses around.
The other piece of that is, it just, the President of the United States is the leader of the free world. Why he's involved at this level of detail with the Ukrainian government, if this was legitimate, there is no reason why the President of the United States would be having a call on a Saturday from the EU ambassador to talk about this. It just doesn't make sense. And one of the things that's also important about the call is that Holmes goes on to say that he took the opportunity to ask Sondland about the president's views on Ukraine. And what Holmes is basically saying, look, is it true that the president doesn't care about Ukraine? And Sondland agrees that the president...
You can use the language used.
Can I?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not even written here. So basically, Sondland agreed the president did not, quote, give a shit about Ukraine, close quote. And Holmes asks why not. And Sondland states that the president only cares about, quote, big stuff. And then, you know, Holmes pushes back and says, look, there is big stuff here. Literally, Ukraine is in a war with Russia. And Sondland replies that when he says big stuff, he means big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing. And so, and then they move on to talk about other things. But it's, that's an incredible thing that, you know, Sondland, he is in over his ski tips for sure. And he's candid in a weird way about this, but it is very clear that Sondland has an incredible problem. I credit Holmes's testimony. I credit Taylor's discussion of it. Sondland is coming back on Wednesday, and he now has to answer. He said that he never had conversations with the president or the White House about the investigations. So what does this mean for Wednesday and Dan Goldman? And
so I think Sondland is an interesting character, right? And he is not going to come across like the people we've seen so far who are buttoned down career diplomats. I mean, probably the most, you know, practiced speakers in terms of the care of words used are diplomats. I mean, sometimes infuriatingly so. And sometimes a good diplomat can talk for hours and not say a goddamn thing. This person not so careful with his words and not so careful with his memory, and it appears not so careful about the truth. He's already modified his testimony in the past. So here's what I presume will happen. There are multiple witnesses to the fact that there was a call between the President of the United States and Gordon Sondland on July 26th. It seems to me that he has to have a recollection of that, and that my prediction is he will admit that there was such a call that had slipped his memory before, and then he will put in an opening statement, as every witness does, and that he, together with his lawyers, will craft some needle-threading statement as to which he will say, and this is all just guessing, he will say, yeah, now that I've had my recollection refreshed, there was a call, it was a busy time, it was brief with the President of the United States that touched on, you know, the issue of what the Ukrainian president would agree to do, and then some version of not remembering this business about the president not giving a shit about Burisma, or not remembering or differently characterizing how that conversation went.
Yeah.
And then it'll be a battle between David Holmes, who I expect will be testifying publicly any day now also.
Yep.
And you know, he knows that. So their recollections will be tested against each other. The problem for Holmes, if you're an effective cross-examiner, is, you know, he didn't take contemporaneous notes. He told people about it at the time. But unlike some other witnesses you see, he didn't put it in writing. It was many, many weeks ago. Wine was being drunk and some, yeah, you know, who knows what people's tolerance levels are. And there's this discrepancy between Holmes, who I think says in his testimony that he let his boss, Bill Taylor, know about the July 26 call. Meanwhile, Bill Taylor says this past week he didn't know about it until a few days before his testimony.
Do you think it's possible that, because I wonder a little bit about this as well, that Holmes said to Taylor, yeah, we had this lunch with Sondland where he called the president and was, you know, bragging on that the investigations were going to happen, that Ukraine would do anything they wanted. But Taylor didn't necessarily connect it until he
was— It's totally possible.
Yeah.
So, look, my guess is that these are, you know, Holmes and Taylor are good faith actors. But good faith actors sometimes forget things. And since they're not sitting in a room and matching their testimony to each other, we've talked about this before, the green hat and the blue hat.
Yeah.
There are going to be some discrepancies, but—
Which is the truth of the world, right? Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, cross-examiners will exploit that, but it is the truth of the world. And I expect that there'll be a reasonable explanation, but I'm curious to hear.
Yeah, and I don't know if there are two other people at that lunch
and
who are sitting off to the side.
Yep.
And I don't know yet, I haven't seen any reporting, as to what they heard and what they saw. If it's the case that they can't corroborate this business about not giving a shit about Ukraine, or the president saying, are they going to do the investigations? You know, that's a point that the other side will exploit.
Yeah. One thing that's worth noting is that I sort of tend to believe that Sondland is going to do exactly what you said, which is to come in and be more honest than he's been. I mean, Sondland is, we talked about him as admit what you can't deny what you can't admit.
I kept thinking about how you make that point when it comes to Sondland. Everyone should look for this. He's exactly that kind of witness that you always describe.
And it keeps evolving, right? So he gets— Taylor testifies that Sondland knows about the quid pro quo. Sondland changes his story. Now you've got Taylor saying, a member of my staff told me this, and then the member of my staff, David Holmes, has been deposed about this. So I think Sondland's going to continue to move as additional information comes out, which it's an interesting point, the discrepancy between, you know, did Holmes tell Taylor at the time? But if Sondland does do what you predict he will do, which I agree with, which is to come in and be more truthful and to remember now that call, it becomes almost irrelevant, particularly if Sondland admits to the bulk of what happened. So they may quibble about exactly what was said,
yeah,
but the fact of that call taking place will not be at issue.
Yeah. And it'll be an interesting thing, both for, you know, Schiff and for the administration to embrace or reject this witness. Because remember—
There's this funny
texting back and forth in September where Sondland is going back and forth with Bill Taylor and Sondland is reciting the party line for the president. There was no quid pro quo. I think you've totally misunderstood. And he had a call with the president in between receiving a text, an agitated text from Bill Taylor about what looks like a shakedown and then returning the text, intervening call with the president of the United States. And so Trump has already in the past publicly placed some reliance on Sondland's testimony. Like, Sondland says there's no quid pro quo.
Yes.
Sondland says this, Sondland says that. And he had this relationship with Sondland. By the way, this idea that the president doesn't know some of these people, and I expect very shortly if the testimony is highly damaging to the president, he'll say, I hardly knew that guy. it takes a certain kind of personality, but I think more it takes a certain kind of relationship to describe the Ukrainian president's, you know, liking President Trump in the phrase that he used.
Yeah,
he loves your ass.
Agreed. It's like the opposite of what the diplomatic corps and the way the diplomatic folks talk.
Right, so depending on how he appears on Wednesday, it might be the case, and this is true in real life too, although it's problematic and it doesn't always compute with a jury, do you embrace the witness or not? Do you embrace some of the things that the witness says because you think that they're good and true and they corroborate what you think and they corroborate your, you know, theory of the case? And then reject the other things because you think they're minimizing? And does the other side do the same, right? So there's good stuff for the president in what has come out so far, and there's good stuff on the side of impeachment,
right,
from what has come out so far. How does that unfold on Wednesday, you think?
And well, I think this is what is going to be complicated for Dan Goldman, the questioner for Adam Schiff, which is Dan is going to have to pin Sondland down publicly to all the things he's already said and acknowledged and admitted. And then he's going to have to push Sondland very hard about the things that he did not state. And Dan is also, I think, probably going to spend a lot of time going through this revised statement, which is, oh, I didn't remember there was a quid pro quo, to, oh, now I remember that I was a part of those conversations. And so I think a good questioner is going to be meticulously sort of pulling those pieces apart with Sondland and really showing and making Sondland go on the record. But then this piece is going to be even more complicated because ostensibly Dan Goldman will know earlier that day because he'll see Sondland's statement. But whether or not Sondland acknowledges this, and if he doesn't, Dan Goldman's going to have to cross-examine him very hard on it. So some of it is taking what you believe to be true and locking that down, and some of it is really pushing on these spaces where Sondland has been, you know, I wonder, I mean, I'm not saying that he's going to get charged with 1001 for lying, but Sondland has not been truthful and forthright. And that's also true, in my view, of Volcker.
Just to finish with Sondland, that's a big motivating factor for him. You have the threat of a lying to Congress charge over your head. And then further to what you were saying a second ago, this is something that maybe non-trial lawyers don't always get, and sometimes new prosecutors don't get. And you think when you have a hostile witness or you have the defendant himself coming to testify on the stand, that it's all fire and brimstone in the cross-examination, and that is not true. You can always get the adverse witness to confirm things that are helpful to you before you turn on them and ask questions more harshly. So if you have a guy who you've charged with being the getaway driver at a bank robbery, you don't go right to the issue of whether or not you were the getaway driver. You ask him, do you own a Buick that's red?
Yeah, you corroborate.
Is the license
everything.
Plate this, that, and the other?
Yes.
You know, you just go through all the facts that he will confirm and get that all out, you know, crisply and quickly. And then depending on the trickier stuff, then you can be tougher later.
Yeah, I agree. And on Volcker, we've got this week coming up, you've got Jennifer Williams, who's a senior official for Mike Pence. You've got Alexander Vindman. You've got Volcker and Morrison. And so let's just talk about Volcker and Morrison for a minute, because they are the ones that the House Republicans asked to be called as witnesses. And so that's interesting in and of itself. Volcker, to my mind, has enormous amounts of exposure because he said that he was a part of the July 10th meeting on Ukraine, but that no one mentioned investigations. And we now have multiple witnesses from the deposition testimony. Ryan Goodman at NYU counted up the number of people that contradict Volcker. It's high. And so there are multiple people who basically say explicitly, including Fiona Hill and Alexander Vindman, who will say, I was in the room. Volcker was also in the room. Here's what was discussed. And so one of the things that's going to be interesting is Sondland has already moved off his testimony by sort of supplementing his statement, again, because he could potentially be charged with lying to Congress. And we'll come back to this in a minute, but Roger Stone was just convicted of lying to Congress. And so anyone who doesn't take this seriously, you know, it's playing with fire if you don't take this seriously. And so Volcker, to me, is also going to be a challenging Q&A with Dan Goldman this week, but a really, really important individual. And again, it's not clear to me whether he actually comes in and tells the truth or whether he doubles down on his lie. But at the end of the day, if he doubles down on the lie, you're going to have a number of individuals come forward and directly contradict his testimony. And I would argue you would have sufficient evidence to charge him with lying to Congress.
Before we end, can I raise an issue that has been talked about a lot, right? Because I keep struggling with this distinction between an ordinary traditional criminal case and impeachment proceedings. And there are all these distinctions, including that we have a hopelessly compromised jury in the impeachment context. You don't have that in the criminal context. It doesn't have to be an actual technical violation of a statute, et cetera. I'm not saying that I have a view on this in one way or the other, but I think it's worth just opening up the discussion about it. Now, if you believe, as I do, that gross and harmful abuses of power on the part of a sitting president of the United States is impeachable and should be punishable by removal, then you have to ask a number of other follow-up questions. So everyone keeps focusing on the state of mind of the president. Was he intending to extort? Was he intending to bribe? Was he intending to do various things? And that's all absolutely fundamental in a criminal case, agreed. But in a criminal case, you're talking about individual liability and a little less talking about the sort of saving of the republic. Here, suppose there's not enough evidence to show that the president had the kind of guilty state of mind. He was intentionally trying to extort, although I think there's a lot of evidence of that. So this is a little bit of an academic exercise, but it's just been bothering me. But that either he was reckless or below the standard, or he has narcissistic personality disorder, or he has some other flaw that causes him not to have, you know, what a court might deem necessary for a guilty state of mind. And yet he's doing the thing.
Yeah.
Right? He's harming foreign policy. And you keep saying, and I think it's an important point to be repeated every time we talk about this, and that is, it's not just that the president was doing something in his personal interest to get these investigations of his political adversaries. He was doing it in a way that was contrary to the United States' national security interest. And if you have a president who is acting repeatedly in a way whose consequence is personal benefit and the other consequence is damage to America, how important in an impeachment context is that criminal guilty state of mind? before Congress can act.
Yeah, I feel like this is a part of the Republican talking points that we're seeing now, which is the president might have done it, but he didn't intend it. Well, that is, to me, it is a very, very odd defense for a number of reasons. First of all, it is, you know, I always talk about this. I always teach, when I teach my class, I'll drop a pen and I'll say, you know, did I do that intentionally or was it a mistake? And, you know, when you drop one pen, it's hard to know whether it was intentional or a mistake. But when there are, but the changing of the light bulb is the other example where I come in, I get on a ladder, I unscrew the light bulb, I put a new light bulb in. There are a number of acts. And so it's a lot easier to judge my intent by the fact that there are a number of acts and pieces versus just dropping a pen. Here, there are a number of acts. And so the idea that this is just one moment in time when it's not clear what the president's intent is.
But you're dodging my question.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I think it's the wrong question, actually, is sort of what I'm trying to say. And what I believe is that this is not, ultimately, first of all, right now, it's not a criminal prosecution at this point. So I think we have to push that aside. Second of all, I think intent can be formed in an instant. I could intend to come to Cafe Insider and change my mind at the last minute and go to the dry cleaners, and I could have intent to go to the dry cleaners. Third of all, the president is on a call where he's asking for, will you do me a favor, though? He's explicitly asking for a benefit. And so it sort of doesn't make sense to me that he would ask for that. Can you do me a favor and investigate my political rival, but not actually intend that Zelensky and Ukraine would actually investigate, said them. Yeah. And so, you know, I want to be careful at saying, I don't think it's fair to say that intent can be inferred from the natural consequence of actions, because I don't believe that. You have to show some intentionality. But here you have the president on a phone call repeatedly asking for investigations. You've got a number of high-level officials. You've got Rudy Giuliani. Everybody's moving for this quid pro quo. Again, the reason why the David Holmes call ends up being really important is you've got Gordon Sondland having a conversation with the president to report back the day after the July 25th call. So my sort of ultimate feeling is there's beyond sufficient evidence of intent here. But again, I'm not sure it's the right conversation to be having because it isn't a criminal case.
Roger Stone was convicted.
Roger Stone was convicted, all seven counts. Roger Stone convicted of all seven counts against him, witness tampering, obstruction of justice, lying to Congress. It's a huge verdict. What do you—
Yeah, look, so it didn't get as much attention as it might have otherwise gotten because of the public impeachment proceedings. And this point has been made a million times. But let's end with, you know, we don't have a thing called guilt by association in this country as a criminal matter. But boy, you can judge a politician by the company he keeps. And think of how many people the President of the United States associates with, has, you know, brought close to him, has endowed with all sorts of authority and power and discretion over his business dealings, who he seems to adore and then later claims he doesn't know. Michael Cohen in prison. Paul Manafort in prison. Roger Stone
going
in prison. Going to prison.
Yeah.
Certainly. Michael Flynn going to prison. It tells you something about a person, about, you know, the company he keeps, and it tells something about the ethics of the President of the United States. It just does.
Yeah, I agree.
So next week, we'll have a four-hour special to review the 91 witnesses.
Yeah, 8 witnesses coming up this week. Lots to cover and lots of interesting happening.
We'll be back next Monday.
Take care.
That's it for this week's Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Ann Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. And the CAFE team is David Tatasciore, Julia Doyle, Carla Pierini, David Curlander, Calvin Lord, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the CAFE Insider community.